This is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and I'm happy to have as my guest a good friend of mine, but also a guy who's been in the business for a long time and has a wealth of knowledge about how it works and what it does, my good friend, Mr. George Dassinger. How are you doing?
I'm good, Mike. I'm so honored to be on the show with you.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I started the show just because I wanted to continue to be creative about 8 years ago. And then almost by accident, I wound up doing probably over 300 interviews, and most of them, as my friends say sometimes, colonoscopy-type interviews. And and I've gotten an awful lot of people in the genre to say an awful lot of things that they've never said to anybody. So it's interesting how that works, and I just do it because I like it. You know, my wife always yells up at me and says, Michael, what are you doing up there? You're editing and you're doing, and you know, it's like, what's in it for you? And I say, Paulette, you don't understand. It's like, I love it.
You know? No, they, no matter how you try to explain it, yep, they won't be able to comprehend why you do what you do.
Right.
Fully, anyway.
We talk all the time. And we talk about trivial stuff and big stuff and little stuff and the music business and how you're feeling and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But I've never really had a chance to dig in, so to speak, and get to the crux of George Dassinger. Because even though we talk just, you know, on the surface sometimes about things, I do know that you have in your career rung all the bells and been there for a lot of interesting, fantastic situations in your life. I do know that they consider you a PR ninja, and I do know that they give you all the accolades. So that is what we're here to do tonight. I want to talk about George Dassinger, the man. So I'm going to start by saying I did an interview that was, 3 hours long with David Brigati. And because it's my show, I can say anything I want. I love him, too. I know him like most of my life. And he says, you live near Dion, don't you? I said, yeah. He says, next time you see Dion, tell him, "F you," from David Brigati. He says, and the next time, and the next time you see Joey D, tell him the same thing. And I said, he says, because I got like 16 gigs that I can remember right in my head right now that I never got paid for. So fuck him. And really and truly, that's why I do this, because it's so real, you know, so real. But of course, the show goes out to some FM feeds, and you know that they get a little
right.
You know, they get a little crazy sometimes, you know, with that stuff, because they still haven't gotten there yet. So, anyway, let's do this, George. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Long Island City, And at age 7, my dad's company moved to New Jersey.
Right.
So we moved then to Jersey City.
Right.
And I pretty much had my upbringing there. That's where I learned all my street stuff. That's where I went to grammar school pretty much in high school. And at 18, then they moved to Bloomfield, New Jersey.
I know, well.
And I remember driving out here for the first time, and I said, why are you moving us to the sticks?
Huh.
And lo and behold, I wind up living out here myself.
Because I know my father moved us around, too. I mean, we went from the Bronx to Armonk to Manhasset to, you know, wherever. And they were in Fort Lee for a while before they actually moved down to Boca, you know, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I covered it, too. And my father, believe it or not, he did a lot of things. My grandfather was the first auto wrecker in America in the Bronx. Sound the auto wreckers, 1908. Believe it or not. And Dion used to buy parts from him. And he also wended his way. He was also a vice president at Belcher Oil, which was in Long Island City. Howard Oil. And then he wound up being a VP at Coastal Oil, you know, before he got sick. And you know, they both passed away in Boca at age 80, my parents. But, we were in Long Island City a lot because my father had an office there for a long time years ago. And you know,
yeah, I have fond memories of Long Island City, even though we moved, well, like I said, when we were seven. But the local crossing guard gave me a dragnet badge, which I long lost somewhere and whatever. But I remember how prized it was, and it was like an official badge with a little blue kind of emblem in the middle, or you know, semi-jewel it was supposed to be. Of course, it was probably plastic. But it was just a great memory, and I used to remember, you know, that I wouldn't go out and play. I had a whole bunch of friends, all on the same street, 41st Street.
Wow.
But until Flash Gordon, the episode of Flash Gordon with Buster Crabbe was showing it, and the serial was over on TV, I wouldn't go outside. I had to watch Flash Gordon. And later in life, Mike, when I'm at Rodgers and Cowan, I'm representing the new Flash Gordon in 1979 when he did that movie in Sam Jones.
Wow.
So I call up a friend of mine who's the talent coordinator at the Tomorrow Show, who's now at The View.
Right.
He's produced at The View, and I said, look, I got an idea. I've got the new Flash Gordon. Why don't you get in touch with Buster Crabbe, fly him in, and we'll put the two Flash Gordons together. And I'll tell you, it was one of the great things that I did, but not that I don't know who a lot of people even know who Buster Crabbe is, but to me, meeting him, I was like speechless, you know.
Ouch. Well, you know, there are the legends and the icons. I mean, look, you're a guy that's been in the business, has probably been in the room with an awful lot of great people, but every once in a while, and I'm that way too, you're in a room with somebody where all of a sudden it's you get a little bit of the hamina, you know? And, you know, I mean, that's just the way it is, because certain people leave an impact on you.
Well, my whole profession was built around working with celebrities and some, you know, it's just who I got to know, you know, and work with and whatever the campaign was or then. But, you know, I was working one of the first things I ever did at Rodgers and Cowan. I had to work that ill-fated Sergeant Pepper movie.
Wow.
And everybody was delegated certain people to work with. Well, yeah, there was an after party at Studio 54 and they said, you take care of George Burns. And I was so elated. I remember saying, you know, Mr. Burns, it's such an honor to be with you. Yeah, 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 kid, get me a drink.
Yeah, cut the crap. Well, I have a story there. Alan Raymer, who was Julie Budd's husband at the time, owned Soundworks. Mm-hmm. My cousin Gary Katz was doing Steely Dan overdubs for the Asia album. And we used to go down in the basement from Soundworks, down across the basement, and up into Studio 54 from the basement. So that's the way we always used to get in. They would say, come on, follow us. I said, where are we going? So we're going next door. We didn't have to go through the front door. You know, we went through the basement and upstairs. You know, that's, you know, I mean, I was lucky. I got to be a fly on the wall in a lot of good places. I had a friend of mine that was a staff engineer at Media Sound during the heydays, and you know, I got to see everybody in the planet record, plus I got studio time there, plus I got, you know, yada yada yada. And his name was Phil Schrago, and he was there with all the bigs, and he was just an engineer on Manilow albums, and Van McCoy, and Stylistics, and you know, you name it, Earth, Wind and Fire, all kinds of crazy people. And I just lived in the cracks and the crevices, and managed to be in good places at good times. The other thing was, and this will tickle you, and I don't know if I've ever said this to you, my brother was the youngest vice president at Burson Marsteller.
No, I didn't know that.
My brother went to work for them as a clerk. I know you'll enjoy this story. And he had a female boss who was a person who was a television personality years before. And she had been on What's My Line and all kinds of things and done TV and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And my brother was feeding her all her ideas, and she was going into Harold Burson and getting gold stars for them. And this went on for about 2 or 3 years. Until my brother, who, you know, was gay, my brother, you know, he was engaged to a girl who actually became Farrah Fawcett's double years later, this girl Andrea, and broke it off and said, you know, I can't do this, I'm gay, whatever. Wended his way, worked for Burson, but he got the courage to march into Harold Burson's office and said, you know, hi, I don't even know if you know who I am. And he said, yes, I think I do. Your name is Richard Miller. And he said, well, you know, do you have a minute? I'd like to talk to you. And he brought his whole portfolio and he said, look, you're either going to throw me out the window or you're going to smile at me. But you know this campaign? Here are all my notes. You know this campaign and that campaign? Yes, here's all my sketches and my notes and my work and whatever, whatever. And I am tired of never getting mentioned, and I am tired of everyone else taking credit for my work and whatever, whatever. And he said, can you leave this here with me? And my brother said, uh-oh. And he said, no, you know, your job is safe. And he got back to my brother. He took the person who was my brother's immediate superior, sent her to Chicago to an office, and made my brother the youngest vice president at Burson at that time.
Good for him.
And my brother did all the PR for We Are the World and some other things. He worked with, you know, a lot of big stars as far as getting them ready to do commercial time. And he went to foreign countries. The president of Columbia, the country, was ready to greet his people on TV. There weren't that much TV things going on then. And my brother went there and stayed like 3 weeks with armed guards and whatever, you know, and was coaching him. You know, he was a paid client. Mm-hmm. How to behave in front of the TV and things like that. I was very proud of him. But he, you know, he contracted AIDS and we lost him well before his time. He was a very talented kid. And Burson paid his complete salary, even though he was on disability while he was sick. They gave him his complete salary during the time that he was sick because they loved him and that kind of thing. It was like a really terrific story. But he had that knowledge, and he was the kid that when he was younger, my younger brother, my parents would go through his pockets to make sure he brought home the correct change when he came home from the store. And we never knew he had this stuff in him, but he did.
You know. How commendable that they paid him and didn't just kick him to the curb.
Absolutely. And, you know, even to this day, and it's a long time now, you know, that he's gone. He was sick for almost 10 years, believe it or not. And, he consulted with them and everything else. But I tried to get one of my daughters a job there, and I called, you know, the higher-ups and whatever, and I mentioned his name. And they immediately put me through to the right people. Of course, my daughter didn't take the job. They offered it to her, you know, at that time. But that was many years ago. And they said, you know, of course we'll remember him. We loved him. And you know, it was a great thing. So he would tell me stories about the business. And you know, truly, my wife and I were glued to Mad Men. And as we went through the ranks, many times I thought about my brother and the stories he would tell me and, you know, how that business really works from the inside out. It's a little bit different than people would imagine.
Oh, it's vastly different.
Yeah.
Mad Men, you know, at least was able to tell the story from, like you said, from the inside out.
Right.
You know, and that's what I think fascinated so many people. But
right.
Whatever they thought of ad agencies, it was nothing like what it was when you worked inside of one. Because I would have clients, I would deal with varying ad agencies, especially at Rogers & Cowan in particular.
Right.
And you know, and you would think, wait a minute, whatever my concept of how they operated, it's nothing near the reality, you know.
Right. And I'm sure, I mean, you know, cutthroat, competitive, backstabbing, you got to read the other person.
Mm-hmm.
He can smile in your face, but you got to read the signs. You become a body language expert. You become a, you got to be a magician. You got to think on your feet. You got to, all those things. I want to go back, you know, with George. So you're living in New Jersey and you're growing up. And what were you listening to musically when you were a kid?
I have an older sister,
right.
And she would play like the Paragons, Meet the Jester,
okay,
or Johnny Mathis.
Okay.
Hey, Mike, John Mathis.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks. It's Johnny Mathis, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
My mom would play Percy Faith, and in those days you would have a hi-fi system.
Right.
And I would listen to all that.
Right. You had a Fisher unit with the turntable and the speakers and the...
Right. And, you know, the speakers, you could take them apart and put them to a different part of the room.
Yeah.
You know, it was just... And West Side Story, I was enthralled with.
Right.
Like, you know, I went to grammar school, but it was a school that at lunchtime they sent you home.
Uh-huh.
So I was a patrol boy, the crossing guard.
That's trust.
And the only reason I became a patrol boy is because you got out of school early.
Okay.
You know, they would let you out. Like, you didn't have to wait until 3:10.
You could
get out at 2:50. And I thought, well, it's worth it. You know,
you had privileges. Was that like being an altar boy or no?
In a sense, yes. And then, of course, they had the belt, and you had to learn how to wear it properly.
All right.
The shoulder harness to it, but they always made you wear those crappy raincoats,
right?
Those long yellow slickers that the water just poured off, and your pants would be drenched at the bottom. So I would never wear it.
In my school in the Bronx, where I was a dean for 30 years, if you wore the belt with a yellow trench coat, whatever, they'd beat the shit out of you, and then they'd let you go to your post.
Well, I would always get in trouble by the teacher who ran the patrol boys. She goes, George Dassinger, you didn't wear your raincoat. I said, I'm never going to wear that thing.
Right.
I said, it's so hot inside of it because it was rubber, you know. That's right.
Yeah,
you know, you would be like 90 degrees inside of that.
Right.
And if it was raining, you would drench inside, and then you would drench. I said, it does absolutely nothing. And so needless to say, I'm patrol boy, and I did all that kind of stuff, and, you know, got sort of merits for it. I took it very seriously, but, you know, I got punched in the mouth.
Nice.
By Moses Timmons. Moses Timmons hated me.
Where is he now?
You know, but his brother goes, he goes, man, he says, you stood up to my younger brothers, you know, and then he used an expletive.
Right.
He said, but you stood up for us, man.
Wow.
He said, you know, you held your own. He said, you know, and I respect that. And his name is Leon Timmons. God knows they're probably both dead by now. You know, but it was that kind of upbringing in Jersey City. And, like, you know, they always talk about how, you know, it's racial profiling.
Oh,
when you grow up in the city, you're all the same.
It's all
the younger guys.
Exactly.
Older cops.
Yeah.
That's how it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I got, they talk about, like, here in New York, stop and frisk. I got stop and frisk more times than I wished to count.
You know, it's just because
I was young, and because I used to hang out on a street corner when I was in high school with about 40 guys, all different ages, which you can't even do today.
No.
It was a wonderful upbringing. And I learned a lot. I learned how to play stickball. I learned how to stand up for myself. I met girls.
Right.
Had a great time.
Right.
But, you know, listening to music, it was slowly creeping into my life as I got older.
Yeah.
Like, my first three albums that I bought, Mike, I bought Sly and the Family Stone,
right,
The Rascals, and Wild Honey by the Beach Boys.
Wow.
And fortunately enough, I got to work with all of them later in my career.
Right. And, you know, getting back to David Brigati, most people don't realize that he was a lot of the brain trust of the Rascals. He sang on all the records, and he arranged all that stuff. And he really didn't get as much credit for it as he needed to.
No, he didn't.
It was a big part of it.
He didn't get credit.
Yeah.
You know, he even did the bird sound.
Right.
And grooving.
Yeah.
That's David.
Yeah.
Grooving on a Sunday afternoon. Thank you. on a Sunday afternoon. Really couldn't get away too soon. No, 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 no. Spending sunny days this way, we're gonna talk and laugh our time away. I feel it coming closer day by day. Life will be ecstasy, you and me endlessly moving on a Sunday afternoon.
I got to meet Eddie and David through a mutual friend, and Felix was going out with Gene and Dino, and they were saying that they were the Rascals.
Right.
So they were over at my house, and I said to them, I said, well, what are you guys going to do about this? And they go, what can we do? I said, you fight them. Mm-hmm. You don't let them get away with it. I said, they're advertising and promoting themselves as the Rascals.
Yeah, I know that. I know
said, it's only 75% of the Rascals.
I know.
So Eddie goes, well, what are you proposing? I said, let's put out a release and let everybody know.
Wow.
Well, we did. We sabotaged the entire tour. They had to cancel it.
Wow.
And later David paid me one of the greatest compliments. He said, George, you taught my brother and I how to fight.
Wow.
And I said, thank you, David. And
wow.
He said, you did. And he said, you know, we were going to just roll over. What can we do? Oh, woe is me.
Right.
But you showed us through media how you could fight and make a stand for yourself.
Well, that's really funny because, you know, I lived in Danbury, Connecticut for many, many years. That's where Harmony Street came from. And I know that
I know that
Felix has ties to Danbury, Connecticut, you know. And what's funny is, you know, I have popped him on the net a bunch of times. I think he wrote me back once. I'm trying to get him on the show because I want to pick his brain. I can get everybody else, but I can't get Felix. He's like playing them. But
he's a bit difficult.
I know.
To put it mildly.
I know. But
and later I got to, I was working and representing the Lone Star Roadhouse, which is the Lone Star moved uptown to 52nd Street.
I know well.
And,
I know where it was.
And Donald Fagen was doing these rock and roll shows,
like
early rock and roll renditions of songs.
Right.
And so I'm meeting with Donald, and I said, well, what are you going to do you got to do something from Steely Dan. He goes, no, that's not what this show's about.
Right.
It's about all these old rock classics.
Definitely.
I said, well, I know how you feel about it, but I'm going to make a prediction. By the time you're going to finish this set and finish this, they're all going to start yelling black cow or something
like
that, and you're not going to be able to get out from under it.
Right.
Sure enough, the night comes, Mike, and everybody's yelling a Steely Dan song.
Right.
And I go upstairs and I go, Donald, they're not leaving.
Right.
You know, there's like 500 people in here. They're not going to leave. They want to hear something. He goes, we don't know anything else.
Right.
So I said, you know, I got Eddie and David Brigati downstairs. Why don't you just sing Groovin' or something?
Right.
You know, something Rascals. Everybody can do that.
Right.
And he goes, would they do it with me? And I went, sure.
Uh-huh.
And so sure enough, they performed and everybody was happy. They got a special song. And later they did that rock and roll kind of Michael McDonald and Eddie and David. And they did that album, and it was because I introduced them to Donald.
Wow.
Your big debut. It's like a dream come true.
Well, you know, what's really funny is that I know Donald didn't like to be up front. You know, I know that that whole story. And I know, you know, I know pretty much the deal. I remember when we were young guys and Gary said, you know, I got the Steely Dan thing, which, by the way, you know, my good friend Dennis Lambert, who, you know, I talked to three times a week, who wrote everything under the sun, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He had a crack at Steely Dan at the beginning and actually passed on it. So I know that whole story, and I know the Jay and the Americans roots, and I know, you know, it's pretty interesting as to how that whole thing went down. But, you know, one of the greatest groups ever to play this stuff, and nobody knows where to put them. Is it rock? Is it jazz? Is it fusion? Is it this? Is it that? But, you know, musically, probably one of the best modern day groups, you know, ever to go into a recording studio.
Oh, no question about it. And Donald, you know, was so fortunate in some ways that a lot of people didn't recognize him. Like, he would take the subway.
Right.
You know, I had him on when Scott Muni used to do those shows at WNAW from the old Hard Rock, where they would broadcast live.
Right.
Well, we had Donald going on the show, and we'll wait, and my wife and I are waiting for him in front of the Hard Rock, and he comes walking up with the New York Post stuck in under his arm.
Right.
And people, nobody even knew who he was.
Right,
and
I can imagine. Course,
and then, you know, he goes on the show, and he's on there with Don Henley.
Right.
And you could tell that they didn't get along. They didn't really like one another musically, perhaps, you know. It was kind of odd, you know, but I figured, well, Scott Muni will handle it. You know, he'll make it work.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, you know, Eagles on stage and in concert, note for note, perfect. Every concert they ever did in their history, nobody ever blew a note. I mean, that's how perfect they were vocally and instrumentally at every show, the Eagles. I mean, you know, and Steely Dan too, although Steely Dan, you know, became a situation, you know, rather than a touring group. They're going to be around here soon, and I know the Eagles are probably going to be down in Miami coming up soon. And, you know, I say to myself, Paulette hates crowds. So unless I can get her in the first two rows, you know, it's like, you know, that's it. So, you know, and it's like concerts nowadays, and you know as well as I do, by the time the tickets go on sale, most of the orchestra is gone.
Oh, yeah.
Or the ticket people buy them up and want you to pay $500 for them. Well, Live Nation takes the first 15 rows for themselves. You know, it's like, you know, it's not like it used to be. And unless you have an in.
Even if you have an in.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I have people that I know.
Right.
But those days of where there would be a block of tickets that
right.
nobody knew about.
Right.
And that management would sell or someone would
I
sell
know.
Like that. They don't even exist anymore because they sell out their shows long before they even step into the venue.
Right.
You know, it's just a different world. I mean, my daughter, Mei Lin, just graduated last night. And at dinner,
congrats.
We're at a diner.
Yeah.
You know, and she says, I want to go to this concert at the Highlawn Pavilion.
Right.
Which is downtown. And I went, Mei Lin, do you know what that is? She said, oh, well, there's going to be seats. I said, there's booths in the Highlawn Pavilion, and the floor is standing room only.
Right.
She said, well, the tickets are only $143 a piece.
Yeah.
I went, what? You're not going to a show and paying $143 a ticket? And my son, Michael, right. who was sitting there with him, he goes, Mei Lin, there isn't a group or an artist in the world that's worth standing for $143, and you got to stand there for 2 or 3 hours.
I know, but you know, it's hard to say that, you know, it's tough. I talk to Dennis sometimes. He says, you know, he's a little influential in Ariana's career, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we talk about, she's around. I said, you know, we'd love to get tickets, you know, and he raises one eyebrow. He's saying, look, do you know the Pope? I mean,
but then, you know, because I work with Little Anthony.
Right, of course.
And Billy Joel idolizes Little Anthony. So
right.
I know Dennis Arfa.
Right.
I called Dennis and I said, you know, Anthony is going to be in town. He goes, well, let me tell Billy. And
right.
so he calls me back 2 days later and says, Billy wants Anthony to come to a show.
Right.
And I said, well, that's really nice. You know, we appreciate. He goes, no. You have to come to the show.
Right.
He said, there's not going to be any ifs or maybe we could do this. He said, you have to let me know right here, right now. He said, Billy wants Anthony at the show.
Right.
So I call up Anthony. He goes, oh, that's really nice of him. You know, well, how much are the tickets? They said, no, Anthony, we're his guests. You know, and I said, they're planning something. I could tell.
Uh-huh.
He goes, no, I don't think so. So Anthony comes in, and it's a Saturday night. It's last summer at Madison Square Garden.
Right.
And so I said, Anthony, let's go. We'll go in early. You know, we'll park early. He said, let's get pizza. Because Anthony says, you know, living in Las Vegas, you can't get New York pizza.
Right.
So we go by the first place, Mike. And he goes, use this smell test. And he goes, no, not enough olive oil in this place.
That's funny.
So then we go across the street and he goes, this is the place.
Okay.
So there we are eating pizza, and we're really early. It's about 6:30.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, let me just call Billy's security guy. I call him up. He goes, and his name's Noel. And Noel says, oh, George, he says, Billy's pacing. He said, you have to come in right now. Come in the service entrance. Come up the elevator. I will meet you in the elevator.
Right.
You're outside the building? I said, yes. So I'm just thinking, well, you know, who knows? So we go up there, and they said, let's take you to the green room. And like you, I've been a lot of green rooms.
Right.
And I'm thinking it's just, you know, kind of a little room they have set aside in the garden. Uh-huh. But we walk in, and it was the most opulent setup I've ever seen.
Wow.
The shrimp were like the size of like dollar bills. They were huge. And there's wine, and there's waiters. I mean, usually it's sort of you help yourself
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
But no, not this one.
Right.
So Billy comes in and he says to Anthony, he says, I'm so honored that you came.
Wow.
And Anthony goes, I'm just glad to be here.
Right.
He said, no, I wanted you here.
Uh-huh.
He said, there's a surprise I have for you.
Wow.
And so he says, well, you know, so they talk for about 20 minutes. He goes, I got to go get ready. And then in the green room, Bill O'Reilly walks in.
Right.
Walter Yetnikoff walks in. And then I realized, Mike, we're not just in a green room. We're in the green room.
Right.
We're in Billy's green room.
Gotcha.
So we, you know, we socialize. Bill O'Reilly comes up to Anthony. He goes, you ever make any money in this business?
Yeah.
Anthony goes, yeah, I made some money, but I lost more money. They stole it from me.
Right,
Bill
right.
O'Reilly says, oh, you got a book coming out? Get me that book. I'll put it on my show. I'll sell your book for
wow,
you,
wow,
which
wow,
was
wow.
really nice. And wow. he did. He did exactly that.
Wow, wow.
About half hour into the show, Billy stops and says, one of my all-time heroes is here tonight, Little Anthony. And he starts singing Tears in My Pillow.
Wow.
And then after he does about a stanza, he says to everybody, stand up. Wow. Like, we got to give Anthony a standing ovation, wow, a New York standing ovation.
Wow.
And everybody stands up, Mike, and they start clapping for Anthony. And I'm watching the tear roll down.
Like 20,000 people.
20,000 people.
Right.
And Anthony goes, he didn't have to do that.
Right. Yes,
Anthony,
he did.
Anthony, that was the surprise, right, that he told, that he said he had for you.
Right.
And he goes, oh, man. He goes, I don't know what to say. I said, just accept it. Just
exactly
enjoy it for the moment that it is.
Right. Rightfully so. You see, that's what I'm always fighting against. I'm always fighting against the fact that the guys that came after the guys that paved the way need to pay homage and need to respect them and need to understand that if not for these people, like the Anthonys and so many of the guys, you know, mm-hmm, that paved the way, the long list that I could go into, but, you know, for lack of time, you know, and the point is they need to understand and they need to specifically pay homage to these people. And so it's great that Billy, who does have doo-wop roots, of course, took the time out to do that. I mean, it needs to be done.
Hi, this is Little Anthony, Little Anthony Imperials, and you're listening to my good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
When he did that last play at Shea, he said, I want to pay tribute to Little Anthony Imperials because I got more girls in the back of my car thanks to those guys.
Right.
Tears in My Pillow.
Right.
And, you know, with Anthony, I've seen it happen many times, like you said, pay respect, like Paul Simon. Anthony cannot come into New York if Paul Simon hears that he doesn't stop up and say hello to him.
Right.
And there was it was a couple of years ago, Paul Simon was bringing back Kate Man. And he was going to do the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And when,
right,
he first did it, if you recall, it literally closed in one night. He got killed,
right,
by the critics,
right,
and lost well over $1 million.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so, but he had the idea to bring it back 10 years later. And Phil Ramone, who was still alive at the time, had seen Little Anthony Imperials down in Wildwood, New Jersey.
Right.
So he calls up Anthony and says, Paul would like you to do this show with him. And Anthony goes, well, what do you want me to do? You know, Anthony, he's got no ego whatsoever. And he said, so Phil Ramone said, I want you to be the time machine. I think that was the thing that was missing.
Right.
I want you and the Imperials to come out on the stage, sing a cappella, and we'll just have a light above you like a street light, like you used to do street singing.
Right.
He said, 15 minutes. So we come out, so they come out and do it, and they did it for 6 nights.
Well.
And Paul Simon, after the first night, got standing ovations, rave reviews in the New York Times that had killed him 10 years before.
Right.
And comes up to the dressing room, and he said, Anthony, I will always be indebted to you. He said, do you know what retribution is?
Right.
And Anthony goes, yeah, I've experienced it. He said, I've waited for this night to happen.
Wow.
And he said, and I'll always be thankful. And it's true. Anthony cannot come into New York if we don't stop up and say hello to Paul. You know, he just loves him so much. And if he hears, like, oh, one of my people ran into you, how come you didn't say hello to me? You know, how come you didn't come up to my offices on Broadway?
You know.
And even when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the 25th anniversary.
Right.
I call up Anthony, I said, well, you know, you're on the show. He goes, no, I think we're going to get bounced. I said, no, I don't think so. And so a friend of mine he's on the board of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he calls me up and he said, George, I'm going to tell you what happened. He said they had a production meeting with the HBO, and they're all 20-something producers.
Right.
And Paul Simon and Billy Joel are in the meeting, and one of the producers said, we're going to take these little Anthony Imperials guys off. I don't want these old farts on this show. And Paul looked at Billy, and Billy looked at Paul, and they said, if he's not on, we're not on.
Wow.
And they both started to get up from the table, walk away, and the guy goes, whoa, wait a minute, maybe I should reconsider.
That's
Paul
funny.
Paul Simon said, reconsider? They should be on before us.
Wow.
And so when you talk about getting that kind of respect, you sometimes do see Bruce Springsteen, too. I mean, he's crazy about Anthony.
Well, you know.
Because they did all those gigs opening it. Bruce Springsteen used to open for Anthony in all those clubs on Route 46 here in New Jersey in the 70s.
See, I have a take on all that. You know, first of all, when Harmony Street went to the White House and we did the 98 Christmas party, it was the first time doo-wop and probably the last time was ever in there for a major event and a concert, you know, for Bill and Hillary at the White House in 98. It was the Christmas party. So Terry Stewart at that time saw us on the Fox News feed going into the White House because they covered us and broadcast us back to Connecticut.
A Danbury doo-wop group has gotten its big break, and it's going to Washington today to sing at the White House. Harmony Street will perform at the White House celebration following the lighting of the National Christmas Tree. Yesterday, Mrs. Clinton unveiled this year's theme at the White House. It is Winter Wonderland. The group got the gig by sending a tape to the White House earlier this summer. They'll get a chance to meet the president, Mrs. Clinton, and crooner Tony Bennett.
Faces and Places news this morning. Supermodel Cindy Crawford recovering nicely, thank you, after a minor traffic accident in California.
Terry lived in Stanford at that time, right?
Yes.
In the Tepan section. And so mm-hmm. he calls up and he says, I want you guys at my New Year's party. So this was a few days after we had just gotten back from the White House or whatever. And of course, you know, Terry's house, you know, looks like the inside of a jukebox, and he had mm-hmm. Percy Sledge's gold record on the wall and this and that and that, da, 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 da. And, you know, Terry being the great guy. And I created a bond with him that lasted for many years after that. And, you know, I was one of the few really outsiders that could get him on the phone whenever I called, and, you know, he found out it was me. Now, I sang with a group called the Islanders when I was 17, 18 years old. We were on Relic Records, the best of a cappella. And in that group was our second tenor, was Jimmy Hanley. Well, then it turned out that his son, Jason Hanley, was one of Terry's right-hand people. At the Rock, you know, and here was a story about a kid. His father wanted to become a singing star, you know, that was his dream. And what happens? His son goes and becomes like in the thick of it and is still at the Rock. I mean, he's one of the historians and whatever. Phil Ramone, I have a friend whose name is Don Teague. He was an eye doctor for the Yankees, and he also happens to be Paul Simon's eye doctor. And I say to him all the time, you know, Paul was a mystic, and I sang with them in the long line of mystics. Paul Simon always says the best thing that ever happened to him was that the Mystics fired him. You know. So Don Teague and Phil Ramone and Lloyd Price have been working for the last few years on the Lordy Miss Claudie Lloyd Price story, you know, the musical. Mm-hmm. And Phil Ramone died in the middle of it. And, of course, now Don is still trying to resurrect that, and I think he's got it going forward. Just moved to the Lauderdale area and whatever. But, you know, it's funny because people say there are 6 degrees of separation. No matter how big a seashell you are on the beach in this genre, you realize there aren't 6 degrees of separation. There are really only one or two. You know, because, you know, you always know somebody that knows somebody, and, you know, it's not that far removed. I want to get back to George.
Sure.
Did you ever sing on the street corner?
No, I had no ability like that whatsoever.
All right.
But the guys that I hung out with, the older guys, used to do that.
Right.
They would sing all the Dupree songs, because Dupree's and Jersey City were synonymous.
You bet, you know. And look at how many guys came from Jersey. Lenny Welch came from Jersey. You know, we can talk about all the Jersey Boys. We could talk about the Shirelles. We could talk. Joey Dean, the Starlighters, have a tune written by David Bugatti called Face of an Angel. It was one of the few ballads they ever did. And if you listen to Face of an Angel, you hear these girls in the background hitting these fabulous harmonies, you know, whatever, to David Bugatti's lead. And, you know, unless you're really tuned in and you know the voices, you wouldn't realize that it was the Shirelles, because they all went to Passaic High School. You know, and so here were the Shirelles, got sucked into doing this ballad, you know, with Joey D and the Starlighters, and should have been a hit, but wasn't.
Hi there, I'm Shirley Austin Reeves, the original lead singer of the Shirelles, and you're listening to Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Great. Give me one more.
Nope. Okay. Hello there, I'm Shirley Austin Reeves, the original lead singer of the Shirelles, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show. Hi Mike, how you doing, baby? Love you, Mike.
I felt the wing of an angel holding me tight.
If you know the tune, it's a great tune.
Oh, I do. No, I do know the tune.
Oh, yeah, you know. And that was another David Brigati, you know, very soulful David Brigati stuff. So anyway, you're listening to music and, you know, you're probably deciding, what do I want to do with my life? And, you know, you're going to school
and
whatever.
I really had no idea what I was going to do. I mean, both my parents were Marines.
Right.
So I would go to Third Marine reunions and
stuff.
Well,
that's very interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. And I met, you know, varying people that were of the Third Marine Division, FBI agents,
wow.
General Waltz, all sorts of people like that.
Wow.
But, and I had some initial idea that maybe I was going to go to the Air Force Academy. But then as Vietnam rolled in and I started to think about things differently.
Right.
I realized that the military certainly wasn't going to be for me.
Right.
And the music, I, you know, changed. I started going to the Fillmore East. I was writing for, I started writing for this paper, or the school paper, then I went to the college paper, and then I later wrote for the Aquarian and became an editor. And so I would always get tickets to all sorts of things. Like
right.
But before you couldn't get tickets those days, I could call up John Shear and get tickets for anything that I wanted to go.
Right.
And was very fortunate. So I saw the Stones at the old Capitol Theater, the Eagles, who you mentioned, the On the Border album.
Right.
I watched them perform that, whether it was Styx, Peter Gabriel, Genesis. I mean, it was just amazing.
And those are the days that Anthony and the Imperials were probably doing the Bottom Line along with the Crests and some of the other groups in those
days.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and I always used to, it's funny how my later career is sort of, I always felt that it was some sort of odd way it took its interesting twist. And I, you know, growing up in Jersey City, I would hear Anthony, I would go to a public pool and they would play on the outside looking in the loudspeakers.
Right.
And I would see Anthony later on, now that I'm, you know, older, would be doing these dates, like I said, on Route 46. And I went, why do they book these guys?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I didn't understand their appeal. I thought, well, they're over. You know, their hits are over. They're not doing anything anymore, and they're sort of basking in an old glory. And now, in this part of my career, I mean, Anthony and I are very, very close friends. I mean, he's the only person that I've ever worked with, Mike, that calls me up on my birthday, called me Father's Day to wish me happy Father's Day, calls me on Christmas.
Wow.
He goes out of his way to do those kind of things. And I have a really good friend, Liz Rosenberg, who does all the PR for Madonna.
Right.
And I was telling her that once, and she said, you only get one in your career. I have Michael Bublé. She said, if I was to pass tomorrow, Madonna would keep calling me on the phone, and why am I not returning her phone call?
Uh-huh.
Michael Bublé would have been there. He said, ready to take care of any last rites that I would have. She said, and I said, that's the difference. She said, but you only get one in your career, and you got Anthony, and I got Michael Bublé.
Wow. Well, you know, that's funny because, as I said to you, I got friendly with John Lloyd Young because I told you this story, but I'm gonna remind you again. I was in New York City just about the time that John was up for the Tony Award, and you know, was it pretty much at the beginning of Jersey Boys, and I was in New York for 3 days at that time. I wasn't married at that time, and we were taking in a couple of shows, and it was like a Sunday, and we were going back to Florida, and I walked into the theater that morning, and I said, I'd like to get tickets to Jersey Boys, and the guy said, for what month? And I said, no, for tonight. And, you know, everybody behind the ticket thing, like, went down on one knee laughing, you know, and they said, what, are you kidding me? You know, it's like, and I said, well, it's too bad, you know, I sing with the Mystics. And he says, you sing with the Mystics? He says, you do not. He says, prove it. So I happen to have a card that had my picture on it. And he says, I'll tell you what. He goes, how about something in the third row? It's about two seats off center, he said. And I said, really? Is that the way it works? He said, sometimes. And so I got the tickets, and we went. So we go, and at the mission, this lady, you know, one of the usherettes, comes over to me with the flashlight and starts motioning to me. And I go, yeah. And she says, and then I got a glass of wine. I had just come back from up on top with a glass of wine. She says to me, you got the guy from the Mystics? I says, yeah. She says to me, they'd like to invite you backstage after the show. And, you know, and I'm going, really? You know, and there were some people sitting around that overheard it, and they were looking at me like, yeah, right. And and so we went backstage, and I met them all at that time, you know, Christian Huff and, you know, all the guys that were in the original cast, and John. And John says to me, wow, he says, you know, do you think we were authentic? He says, you know, like, how did it sound? I said to him, go home and lick your Tony. And he laughed. And that was it. We took pictures and the whole thing. And I went home. All right. Comes all this time later. I have the show. He's in the movie. The movie's coming out. I call his manager. And I say to her, it's Mike Miller, whatever, da, da, da. And I get her on the phone finally. And I says, I'd like to do an interview with John. She says, well, he's doing 8 a.m. New York tomorrow. And he's doing this and he's doing that. And he's going to be, you know. She says, why should I give you an interview? I said, I don't know. I said, do me a favor. I said, when you speak to him next, tell him that Mike Miller wants to do an interview with him. It was the guy that came backstage that time and told him to go lick his Tony whenever, da, 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 da. She says, well, you know, she says, I don't know, you know. So she calls me back later that afternoon, and we happened to have the same last name, her and I. And she says to me, John says, whenever you want to do the interview, he's ready to do it. So she sends me his new CD, which is My Turn, because he doesn't want to be an actor anymore. He wants to be a singer. He wants to be a Michael Bublé. He wants to be a pop guy. And the guy's got phenomenal chops. I mean, you know, super, super duper. So we do the interview, and one of the tunes on the CD is Hold Me, Throw Me, Kiss Me. And he goes on and on and on about how Mel Carter is his idol, and, you know, it was the greatest 60s song, and he loves the tune, and he picked it, and it's the lead tune of the CD. So I said, well, you know, Mel's a very good friend of mine. I talk to him a lot, and, you know, he said, oh, my God. So we finished the interview. And then I called Mel up right afterwards. He says, get him back on the phone and conference me in. He says, I want to talk to him. So I call him back. It's John. He says, yeah. I says, it's Mike. He says, oh, you know, what's wrong? I says, somebody wants to talk to you. I says, Mel, are you there? So I says, Mel, you know, John Lloyd Young, Mel Carter. And he became like a 9-year-old kid. Oh, Mr. Carter, he was fumbling. So Mel says, call me Mel. All right, so that was great. They did 10 minutes. It was great radio and whatever. And he says, oh, you're my hero, da-da-da-da-da. Then John is doing some cabarets in L.A., Beverly Hills area, whatever. And since Mel lives out there, not far, I get the idea. It was a brainstorm. I called his manager. I said, wouldn't it be nice to have Mel in the audience when John opens up for this cabaret to do his show? And he can do Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, and we'll have Mel at ringside. She's jumping out of her seat. You could do that? Yeah. So I call Mel. We get the whole thing done. He surprises him. He does the whole thing. It was like kissy huggy, brings him on stage, the whole thing. Well, for that performance in 2014, John won the Broadway Cabaret Award for Best Cabaret Performance for 2014. And you know, that was really a nice thing. You know, it was a good thing. You know, and it was like, I says, you know, it kind of made me feel good. So now we fast forward. And she says to me, I got to get him new material. He wants to be a singer. She says, I'm more of a movie, Showtime, you know, whatever. I'm not a music person. I says, well, let's think about songwriters. I says, Dennis Lambert is a good friend of mine. He wrote Everything in the World. You know, all the Tavares tunes. We Built This City, Ain't a Woman Like the One I Got, Night Shift, you know, on and on and on and on and on. And what he didn't write, he produced. So she says, you know Dennis? So anyway, after that, John's been secretly sneaking into Boca, you know, and meeting with us and doing some things and whatever. And Dennis is trying to get him some really good music management because now is the time. If he,
right.
You know, and the kid is so talented. I mean, I can send you some of his stuff, you know, just for kicks, and I will.
Thank you.
But here's the thing. He's getting movie offers. He's not so sure that he wants to do that. It's got to be the right material at the right time and whatever. And he's got to stop for doodling. He's got to get somebody that can seriously move him quickly, get his name out there again, because, you know, Jersey Boys was a B movie. I think right. Walmart bought the rights. That's where they made their money and whatever, you know, he received a lump sum to do the movie. And, you know, it's like, what now? He got pigeonholed playing Frankie for 10 years. Frankie never really appreciated it. You know, calls him the kid, you know,
right.
And doesn't say his name, just calls him that kid. And truly, between you and I, he did a lot for Frankie. Whatever. So
but Frankie,
you know, well, you know, and I do know that, you know, they've been to functions together where Frankie's turned around and said, why is he here? You know,
and that's also Frankie.
Right. You know, and so, you know, there it is. But, you know, I'd like to see him move along. He kind of deserves it. He deserves it. He could be a phenom. He's not for the young kids because he's 38 years old, you know. He's
well,
not
that signature song, you know. That's really what it comes
that's
down to.
Why,
you gotta have the signature song.
That's why the material.
Hi, this is John Lloyd Young, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Hold me, hold me, never let me go until you've told me what I want to know, and then just hold me. Hold me, make me tell you I'm in love with you. Thrill me, thrill me, walk me down the lane where shadows will be hiding.
you make me tell you I love you. They told me, be sensible with your new love. Don't be fooled, thinking this is the last you'll find. But they never stood in the dark with you, love. When you take me in your arms and drive me slowly out of my mind, kiss me, kiss me, kiss me. And when you do, I know that you will miss me, miss me. If we ever say adieu, so kiss me, kiss me. Make me tell you I'm in love with you. Kiss me, kiss me, kiss me. And when you do, I know that you will miss me, miss me, miss me, miss me. If we ever say adieu, so kiss me, kiss me. Make me tell you I'm.
Want to be like, you know, Michael Paré and Eddie and the Cruisers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just don't, you know,
right.
You got to break away from that.
Well,
know?
You know,
luckily
but,
you've got a friend like you that'll help.
But did Michael Bublé ever really have that signature thing going on other than doing some great, great covers, you know?
Right, but, you know, he's
Michael Bublé.
He's the Christmas special.
Right.
The Christmas specials help him a lot.
Well, of course.
And that's another thing to do, you know.
Listen, listen. Did Darlene Love need to be in the... I love Darlene. I'm friendly with her. I've known her for years. She was on every record, including Johnny Angel, and records that nobody even realizes she was on. Did she deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ahead of some other people? You know, I don't know, but let's say that the connection with the boss and with Paul Schaefer and that little nucleus didn't hurt, and she was very smart to be there. So,
well, it's, you know, like you were sort of, you know, circling around, but it's a who you know business.
Oh, you
know the right people, things can get done.
I mean, when
I first started working with Anthony, everybody said, "Oh, they'll never get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame."
Right.
I went, "Oh yeah,
yeah."
We'll see about that.
Well, you know, it's, you know, let's talk about Johnny Maestro. I mean, you know, I've Terry Stewart told me, and I did it, you know, his interview was really a cool interview because I laid it right as I hit him over the head with a sledgehammer. I said, you know, Johnny Maestro. He says to me, well, you know, there's two things with Johnny. First thing is 16 Candles, you know, number one, big, you know, da, 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 da. Then there's a sliding scale. Some of his tunes, you know, when you talked about Step by Step and the Angels Listened In and whatever, whatever, they weren't really digging that tune in on the West Coast as much as they were digging other things and whatever,
right.
Da, 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 da. Okay, there's all of that. And he said, you know, sometimes timing is everything. You know, you gotta, he says, I only get one vote. He says, believe it or not. And the nominating committee is a different animal now. They've passed that now, you know. They're starting to do the rockers, and there is a click, just like there's a click in everything else, and it's politics, and it's this, and it's that, and it's, you know, and like everything else, they start to form, you start to get the us and them, the oldsters, the youngsters, you know, the left, the right, the up, the down, the blue, the red, you know, and it's, you know, you get divisions. It's like every other entity that's like that.
Look at Nile Rodgers, has been up with Chic for 10 times.
I know.
Didn't make the final cut. But the thing with Anthony that made it work,
right,
was when I first met him, Mike, he was here in Jersey, and they were playing the Meadowlands doing one of those doo-wop shows. And
right.
Sold it out. But the booking agents, to keep your money down, would only give you half credit. And I'm going, you're the headliner, and they only give you 50% of the house?
Right.
And Anthony goes, oh, we've forgotten. Nobody cares about us anymore. We just do these dates. I'm not happy with them. I do a half hour. Like, I'm just getting warmed up, and it's over, and everybody, all the lights are coming on. And
right.
But, you know, we make money, and, you know, I guess this is what our lot in life is.
Right.
And I said to Anthony, I said, no, you have to do a campaign.
Right.
You can't, you just can't let people forget. I said, and there are people who just don't know. So if you do a campaign and you lay out your legacy, and then I said, and I always do the math, and I said, you know, next year is your 50th anniversary in show business.
Right.
And Anthony goes, who cares?
Right.
Like, you know, he said, how many people do you know have survived in this business for 50 years?
Right.
And he all of a sudden, he looked at me and he goes, you're the guy. You're the guy. You're the guy I've been waiting for. You're him.
Right.
And I felt so complimented.
Wow.
And, but then I added, I said, Anthony, if I don't get you on television, though, no matter what PR campaign, no matter what stories you do,
right.
no matter what magazine I get you on, we live in a visual age today.
Right.
You got to be on TV. So he said, well, you know, those talent bookers, they're not going to know who I am. So how are you going to do this? And I go, I don't know. I don't know yet. So then, as fate would have it, Mike, you know, because I was at Elektra Records in the 80s,
right.
I ran their PR department. I used to deal, of course, with Rolling Stone. Well, Sharon, Sheila Rogers, wrote Random Notes for Rolling Stone time. She's now executive producer at The Letterman Show. So I bypassed the talent coordinator and went right to Sheila.
Right.
So I call her up and I tell her who I'm, and I said, Lil Anthony. And she says, Lil Anthony Imperials. She goes, that would be interesting. She goes, but, you know, really this is, we do meetings. And that's how these things are decided. It isn't just Paul wants something and that's
right.
how we do it.
Right.
That everybody thinks that, but everything's done by committee here.
Right.
And she said, and David's got a say in it too. Everybody has a say.
Right.
So she said, let me call Paul. So I guess it was about a week or two goes by. And Paul Schaefer calls up and says, and he goes, are you George Dassinger? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, here's the deal. He said, we want to do Hurt So Bad the way Teddy Randazzo did it in 1965.
Right.
And I went, Paul, I don't know going rates for union and scale,
right.
but you're talking about violin players, background singers, timpani, your band, Anthony's orchestra leader. I said, you know, I don't know, $10,000 maybe?
Right, right.
And he goes, no, it's going to cost the show $13,000 to do a 2.5-minute song.
Well.
So I said, well, is that approved? He goes, yeah, I have it approved. Now now here's the bad news. Since it's going to cost the show $13,000, I have no money to fly these guys in. I don't even have money to give them for a taxi cab to get down to the Ed Sullivan Theater.
Well,
they're going to have to come in on their own dime. And I'm going, oh, well, I don't know about this.
Right.
So I called Anthony, and Anthony goes, let's do it, George. Let's just do it.
Right.
He said, so what if it costs us money?
Right.
You know, so long story short, they go on. It was even Letterman came up to Anthony and said, that was great television.
Right.
He said, it just was great television.
Right.
Fate would have it, the nominating committee was all in New York, staying in a hotel room. They're all kind of having a meeting, had dinner in their room, and someone said, let's put on the Letterman Show.
Wow.
And a friend of mine who is on the, Bob Merlis, who's on the committee, told me later,
right.
he said, everybody stopped eating as we listened to Anthony sing Hurt
well,
So Bad.
Well.
We were floored that he could still sing
right.
like on key and still do what he does.
And then some.
And so and he said it went around the table, everybody going, and Anthony had been up, I think, Little Anthony Pierce had been up maybe three times before that and didn't
right.
make the cut.
Right.
He said, George, he said, we went around the table. He's a shoo-in.
Wow.
After that, and that's the thing that cinched it.
Well.
You know, that later, you know, they didn't tell me that at the time. It wasn't like, see, this is August of 2008 on the 26th of August.
Wow.
They didn't tell me until we were in Cleveland in April that how the whole thing evolved.
Hmm.
And he said, you tell you the truth, George, had you not gotten them on Letterman Show, I don't think they would have ever made it.
Here we are. Our next guests are a great rhythm and blues group who this year are celebrating their 50th anniversary, ladies and gentlemen. Congratulations, everybody. Their forthcoming CD entitled You'll Never Know. Please welcome Little Anthony and the Imperials. Harold, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Little Anthony and the Imperials, thank you very much, everybody. Great job.
Yeah.
That's it. We'll see you tomorrow night. Good night, everybody.
Wow.
So a lot of that has to do, you know, there's always the dispute of who should be in. How come Joe Cocker isn't in?
Right.
You know, they can always throw names around. But, you know, when it comes to the nominating committee, sometimes you got to win them over just like you got to win in somebody else over. But on the other side of it, the talent coordinator for David Letterman did call me after that and told me that I went around her back and don't ever do that again.
You know that everybody has an ego in this business. And,
that's true.
And you know, and that's just the way it is, because I always try to go right to the top. I do it when I buy a car. I do it with everything that I do because, you know, it's like I want that person to know who I am, you know, and you know, that's the one you're making the deal with anyway in the ultimate, because let's put it this way. If you went through the person on the third rung of the ladder, she was just going to have to climb up the next two rungs to ask the person on the eighth rung of the ladder anyway. But it was the point of, you know, she needed to feel important in this whole
right.
thing.
I do the same thing. I could never understand, you know, start at the bottom, work your way up. I said, no, I'll start at the top and work my way down.
Of course. If you shoot for the top, even if you fall down two rungs,
right.
you are still way up there. You know, I agree with you 100% on that. You know, it's funny the way that works, man.
It was an epiphany kind of thing. I mean, when I got out of college, I couldn't get a job. Every job I went for, I was overqualified, which nobody ever tells you. You can be overqualified.
Yeah, that's a big word. I want to know how you wended your way into doing this because not everybody can do this.
All right, so to backtrack, you know, I went from Bloomfield College writing the weekly college, you know, music page, to working for the Aquarian, and then I took over an editorship of this other New Jersey weekly. I was with the Aquarian for 2-3 years. And then this guy I know was starting another rival weekly paper, and he said, I'll give you the whole entertainment section, half the paper, 16 pages.
Right.
And so friends of mine, I was working in the post office at the time in New Jersey, in the Balkan Foreign Mail Center.
Uh-huh.
And I had friends there that, you know, were music fans, and so I was able to get them to write, you know, like it was like a dream come true for them to review a record and have their name in print.
Right.
So, as fate would have it, when I was in Bloomfield College and writing, I'm loading trucks at UPS, and a guy that I became friends with, a guy named Joe Dara, he goes, how do you get all these free records? And I told him how I did it, you know, And I said, I write for the school papers. He said, well, I'm going to start doing that for my school.
You should have said, I open the mail. I open up the mail.
And you know, but Joe at one point quit school and said, you know, I'm just going to go into the music business. And I said, oh, and we stayed in touch. He became a road manager, you know, had these British trio bands that he hated, you know,
right.
would just take them on tour, do what they had to do. And as soon as he could put them on a plane at JFK and send them back to England, he did. And then he went to work for a PR company called Levinson PR, and then he went to Rogers and Callan.
Huh.
So he called me up one day and said, I'm working in the post office, and said, he said, I need help here. Can you take a day off and come in and work?
As long as he didn't say, you know, the mail is piling up, we need you downstairs.
No, they actually had two guys work in the mail room. And it was, the Balkan Foreign Mail Center really is like, was packages. And,
right.
and magazines. Uh-huh. You know, they didn't deal with, like, regular letters.
Right.
It's just a big postal factory, for lack of a better term. It's still there.
Right.
But, so he said, come in and you know, and so I'm thinking, I look at their client list, and it's like Paul McCartney.
Wow.
Hall and Oates and Chicago and Bee Gees, and I'm going, oh boy, okay, it's work. So I go in there and they give me the Tavares Brothers to work.
Uh-huh.
And I knew some hits, but I didn't know them. But I got on the phone and just pitched it. And I had a whole bunch of interviews for these guys. And so Joe said, he goes, you really did a good job. He said, do you know what you're doing? I said, no. But, you know, I said, I just kind of pitched it. You know, when they would ask me a question, I would say, well, why don't you ask one of the Tavares Brothers that? I don't know how they did that song. And they go, oh, okay. And so I became very good friends. And so I did this for like a whole day. And then went back to work in the post office.
Do you know who my interview is with this week?
No.
Chubby Tavares.
Ah, I love those guys. You know, they made me a brother.
Wow.
When I later worked for them, they made me a brother.
And I didn't know that. And, you know, we could have worked that into the interview. But what was really funny is that, you know, coming back around to Dennis Lambert, you know, he wrote everything they did. Remember What I Told You to Forget. And,
sure.
You know, I mean, he put them on the map. So.
Thank you.
I, you know, time goes by and Joe calls me up again and says, look, there's an opening here for a manager in the music department and I want you to come in for it. So I go in to do the interview and yeah, I guess I did okay. But then I call up Joe and he says, oh, we got to hire this kid. He said, we just signed the New Jersey Film Commission and they want us, and politically we're going to have to hire his son. And so he goes, I'm sorry. He said, you'd be perfect for this. And, you know, I love, you know, we're all friends. Like, we loaded trucks together. How cool it would be.
Right.
I go, Joe, what are you going to do? You know, I said, just chalk it up. So 6 months later, calls me up. We stayed in, you know, in touch. I go and see him occasionally, and we'd have lunch and whatever. And he called me up, and he said, this guy Larry is such a loser. He stays in his office all day, does absolutely nothing. I can't stand him. I'm going to get rid of him.
Yeah.
So he said, I want you to come in, you know, to the, meet Paul Block, who really runs the entertainment division at Rogers & Kent. Paul Block's still at Rogers & Kent.
Right.
Represents Stallone and Schwarzenegger and, you know, Bruce Willis. I mean, he's got all those heavyweights. And so so he said, meet us at the St. Regis. So I'm there at 8 o'clock in the morning. I go in the breakfast area and sit down, and they said, we want to give you the job. And I'm like, really excited. And I said, well, okay, I'm going to order some breakfast. And Paul goes, no, you can't order breakfast. And I went, why? He said, well, because Larry is coming in about 15 minutes and we're going to fire him. He doesn't know he's being fired yet. So, and we don't want you here when he's here. I said, I understand. So there I am, Mike. It's 8:15 in the morning. I'm out on the street, probably with the best news I could ever have, with nobody to share it to. Nobody to even, you know, express it.
And there were no cell phones then, I would imagine.
No, there were no cell phones.
Right, there you go.
So I'm at Rogers, so I'm now at the post office. I go back in and I announce to all these tour supervisors that I'm leaving. So I remember all these guys, a guy named Joe de Blasio ran them. And he goes, George, you have to come into the boardroom. And it was like the scene in The Untouchables, you know, all these Italian guys sitting around the table
right.
Smoking cigars in a building you're not supposed to smoke in.
Right.
And there, so I walk in there and one tour supervisor, Tony Pepe, stands up. He goes, George, he said, I want you to reconsider. He said, you have a way with people. We want you to stay here.
Well.
And he said, you know, you'd be really good. You can be here with us. There'd be a seat for you at the table. And Joe de Blasio stands up and goes, Tony, shut up. He said, just shut up. He goes, I'm telling George what I feel. He said, shut up. Sit down. Shut up.
Hmm.
He comes over and walks up and puts his arm around me and says, my nephew is John Travolta. You know that, right, George? I said, yeah, I do know that. He said, you know, they always told him, kid, you'll never amount to anything.
Uh-huh.
Don't go into show business. Don't do this TV show. Don't do this movie. He said everything they told him didn't do, he succeeded in.
Right.
You go to this PR company and you take it over, George. He said, that's what you'll do. He said, you got a destiny. And don't listen to this idiot here, Tony. Don't listen to any of these people.
Uh-huh.
In fact, don't ever come back here again. He said, leave this behind you. So that's exactly what I did. So then I went to Rise and Count, and I think, oh, I'm now going to get some really great client. Well, they always gave me all the clients that they didn't want to deal with. But, you know, Mike, it became a great experience in more ways than one. Like, they didn't want to work the Beach Boys anymore. I went to the White House with the Beach Boys. I went to George Bush's house.
Wow.
I mean, I Chicago, worked Chicago when they were doing 5 days in Central Park.
Hmm.
You know, I worked with the Tavares brothers.
Yeah.
I went on the road with Rick James. I was the only white guy. I had to do Rick James Week.
Wow, was that where the you and I?
Yep, and his, you know, his whole group, all the background singers,
right.
everybody's black. I'm the only white guy.
Funky
and
guy.
And the first thing he comes up and says, he goes, "You're the Rogers and Cowan guy." And I went, "Yeah." And I said, "I'm here to promote your week." He goes, "Well, I'm going to tell you. First of all, I don't like white guys." And he said, and "Secondly, I'm not going to be any help to you whatsoever because," he said, "I party all night, I sleep all day, and then I do whatever I do after that. But I'm not going to help you at all, and we'll see how good you are."
Uh-huh.
And I go, "You're right, you will see how good I am." So uh-huh. I get back to my hotel room, I'm going, oh my God, I've never had to work a client who absolutely refused to help me.
Right.
And I thought, all right, stop feeling sorry for yourself. What are you going to do? So I, in those days, there were so many columnists like Earl Wilson, and there was just a bevy of them. So I just called up all of them, got Rick James Week in Buffalo. And then after I did that, I thought, all right, well, what am I going to do now? And then I figured, wait a minute, they got to name a street after him. It must be the street that he was lived on. And I imagine his mom's still there. So I was like, you know, like in Terminator, looking for Sarah Connor and
the
directory. I'm looking, James. And then I found the street. I go, that's got to be her. So I call her up and I tell her who I am. And I tell her what her son said to me, how he's going to be absolutely no help. She goes, oh, that boy of mine, he's always been difficult. She said, but so I said, well, I've got all these TV stations, three different TV. They want to cover them all week. Would you do the interviews? So long story short, again, I have her do all these TV interviews.
Wow.
So Rick James at the end comes up to me and goes, he said, man, I owe you an apology.
Right.
He said, my mom loves you, man. He said, she thinks you're the one. And he said, I know I was difficult. He said, but, you know, I was messing with you, man. I said, no, you were messing with me. Uh-huh. He said, yeah, but look what you did.
Right.
He said, it worked out better than me. He said, she's a better interview than I am any day.
Right. But, you know, that's true. Well, you know, wasn't it always when you were younger and you pulled up in the car, if you could charm the mother, you know, then,
that's right.
Then the girl, you know, you got to charm the mother first. You got to, you know, it's like there's a method to the madness, you know.
Well, it sort of taught me that, you know, maybe I have to do things a little bit differently. You know, whatever the traditional ways of what they were deeming publicity, I never saw it as publicity. I always saw it as marketing. I mean, if you got the right exposure, you could sell. I mean, like when Linda Ronstadt would go on the Tonight Show, she would sell, you know, 250,000 albums
right.
the next day. That
right.
was marketing.
Right.
It wasn't publicity. And so I thought, well, that's the way it's going to go. I kind of foresee this. So lo and behold, now I'm at Rodgers and Cowan. I'm, you know, and working all these music acts and stuff. And Andy Gibb was a client of mine. I loved working with Andy. I mean, in fact, one day his manager calls me up and says, George, you need to do me a favor. And I went, what, Mark? What do you need? He said, I want you to call up Andy and convince him to go on Good Morning America and talk about his cocaine addiction.
Uh-huh.
And I went, what? I said, he's not going to do that for me. He said, yes, he is. I already talked to him. He said, but he wants to hear it from you.
Uh-huh.
I said, why? I've only been with you guys 3 or 4 times. He said, he just has such respect for you. He said, believe me, if you call him, he'll do this. I've got it all set up, but he won't do it for me. So I go, all right. So I call up Andy, and he says to me, do you realize what you're asking me to do, George? You're asking me to bear the most inner secret, the most horrid thing that I do to myself, that I've got an addiction to cocaine, and go on national television and bare my soul in front of the world.
Open my amazing Technicolor dream coat for the world to see.
Right. And I went, you're right, Andy. That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what I'm asking you to do. I said, I didn't set this up. I said, you know, Mark set this up. I said, and it's already, but you wanted to hear from me. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll do it on one condition and one condition only.
Yeah.
I said, what's that? He said, first of all, Barry has nothing to do with this. And he said, and secondly, you have to come with me. I said, I'd be there with you, Andy. What do you think? I would do this and not show up and not be there? As sitting in the green room, as you get nervous, thinking about what are they going to ask you, I'll even find out what the questions are in advance. And here's another little bit of fate. The talent coordinator for it was a woman named Kathy Vassopoli. Kathy Vassopoli is Mrs. Paul Schaefer.
Wow.
So we had and Andy went and did it. I mean, he really, and then I realized, you know, maybe I do handle this a little bit differently. But everybody I ever made fun of wound up being a client, like Paul Williams. I would see Paul Williams on a TV show, you know, before I became a professional. I go, what is he on this show? What is he on The Odd Couple? What has he got to do with The Odd Couple? And then Paul Williams became a really good friend of mine and a client, and I had a great time with him.
Wow.
I mean, I met Jackie Gleason thanks to Paul Williams because they were doing Smokey and the Bandit 3.
Ah.
Went down in Florida on that highway that doesn't exist, you know. That's where they were shooting it. And he introduced, and you would call, it was Pat McCormick and Paul Williams. He would call them Laurel and Hardley. So, you know, at Rise and Count, like I said, now I'm like in the music division, and I'm doing okay. You know, I got quite amazing experiences and went to the Bahamas with the Tavares Brothers. And like I said, I went to the White House with the Beach Boys. But one day, Henry Rogers, you know, of the Rogers and Cowan,
right,
kind of became like a mentor to me in a lot of ways. He said, I'm coming into New York, George, and he said, I'm going to have a meeting and I want you to sit in it. Now, Mike, I've got really long hair, very rock and roll,
all right,
jeans, T-shirts, you know. And I go into this meeting and it's all these two corporate guys,
right,
you know. And they start, so Henry says to them, tell them what your problem is with this client. And they start going through this whole litany of, they want, you know, he's a very successful businessman, but they can't get him arrested. And the publications won't cover, in those days, publicly, they only covered publicly held companies. They wouldn't do a story on somebody that was a privateer, so to speak.
Okay.
And they're just going, they got knocked down by Time, got knocked down by AP Business. They were just going through a one after another. And so Henry looks at me and goes, what would you do? And I said, well, why are they beating their heads against the wall?
Mm-hmm.
I said, he said, he goes, well, George, they're about to, this client is a really good friend of mine. He's about to fire me and fire our firm, and we make a lot of money off of him, and I don't want to lose him. So what would you do? I said, I wouldn't beat my head against the wall. He goes, I don't understand what you mean by that. I said, well, if all the business press won't do him, why don't you go to another area of the media?
Right.
The guy does his own TV commercials.
Right.
Pitch him. I could pitch him to the TV editors,
uh-huh,
and TV columnists. They'll cover him because other than Frank Perdue, Victor Kiam's the only one who's doing his own TV commercials.
Right.
So Henry looks at me and he says, can you sell it? I said, no, give me 2 weeks, Henry, and I'll let you know. So 2 weeks later, I had him doing all these interviews with TV editors. He fired the two guys that ran the corporate division.
Well,
and then he made me a vice president, and now I'm running the corporate division. So I got my hair cut, I'm wearing suits. I've got all these corporate clients, but yeah. Rise and Count being an entertainment-based public relations firm, all their corporate clients were entertainment-based. So then I'm representing Winston-Salem, R.J. Reynolds, dealing with their PR, their ad agency, Larry Wassong. All of a sudden, I've gotten this whole new circle of people that I'm dealing with.
Right.
Cronenberg Beer. I mean, I just did all these campaigns. But they all had an entertainment twin, so I sort of knew where to go with it. And, and lo and behold, Victor Kiam, I represented him then for 17 months. And it was true. Once the TV editors did him, all the business press started covering him.
Wow.
But he was a despicable human being to work with. God, he was, and he later took over the Patriots, if you remember.
Right, I do remember.
Yeah, and threw like female journalists out of, sports writers out. I mean, he's
right.
Not a nice guy. And I was, eventually, he brought in this one product called an aroma disc player, which kind of, you put it on and you would, popcorn smell would go through the room. So he had us in the conference room at Rise and Count, which we were on, then on 42nd in Lexington, and going around the room and everybody's like kissing up to him, you know, oh, Vic, this is going to be a big hit, big. And I think, you know, after 17 months of representing this guy and doing what most people couldn't have done,
right,
I figured, you know, I could just tell him anything and be truthful.
Right.
So I'm the last person they get to. And I go, no offense, but I said, other than Christmas time, this thing's a bomb.
Right.
Nobody's going to give a damn about this thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, Mike, he went off on me, screaming, yelling at me in
right.
front of all these people.
Right.
And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, what do I do now? You know, he's using every expletive and just really driving me into the ground.
You should have said, tell me how you really feel.
Well, I figured I'm just going to sit there and take it. And when the meeting
right.
got up, I walked out,
right.
went into Henry Rogers' office, and I said, I'm resigning this account. I'm not going to work this asshole anymore. And he goes, Henry grabs his heart, and he goes, George, don't do this to me. I said, nobody talks to me like that, Henry.
Right.
Nobody. I said, yeah, the way I grew up, nobody ever talks to me like that.
Right.
He said, well, you got to write what you want. I said, no, Henry, I will never work with this asshole again.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, he did fire my company. He did fire Rogers and Cowan. And then at that point, I'm a vice president, and I realized I thought about as far as I could go here. and a friend of mine who was in the Beverly Hills office was leaving to go to another PR firm. He called me up and he said, there's an opening in the New York office for the same PR firm. And George, we work so well together. Why don't you take the job? He said, you'll even get a pay raise.
Right.
So I go and I worked and I started there. It was a company called Lippin and Grant, and Evelyn Shriver ran the office and still good friends to this day. But they were representing Elektra Records, and Teddy Pendergrass had just had his accident, making him a quadriplegic, and
I remember.
A new album. So I worked it, and it was really great meeting Teddy. I mean, I thought, here's the guy that was the most virile, sexy singer to step forward in a long time, and now he's a quadriplegic. And so they did the record, and, you know, I got a lot of press for Teddy, and but I didn't get along with Dick Lippin and Richard Grant very well. They were very opinionated and didn't let, you know, I had clients of my own. They were trying to tell me how to do what I should do. And I said, look, I've had these clients for 2 or 3 years, and you're now going to tell me how I should work them? You guys don't know what you're talking about. So I always had odds with them. And fate would have it, the woman who ran the PR department for Elektra Records called me up and said, meet me for lunch. And I'm thinking she's going to just congratulate me for doing a good job with Teddy Pendergrass. The first words out of her mouth, she said, her name is Bryn Bridenthal, and I'll always be indebted to her.
Right.
She said, I want you to take my job, but you got to take a $20,000 pay cut. Interested? And I always wanted to go to a record company, and I did take the job, and I have no regrets. I mean, my office overlooks St. Patrick's Cathedral. It was like right, like, you know, it was right in Rockefeller Center.
Wow.
I got to work with the Cars. I got to work with Simply Red. But, you know, everybody's typecast. And the black music division, the guy who ran it, calls me in and says, who are you going to hire to do all the black music? And I said, I'm not going to hire anybody. And he goes, well, who's going to do it? I said, I'm going to do it.
Right.
He goes, what do you know about black music?
Duh.
I said, well, I was raised listening to Smokey Robinson on one, listening to one song, and the Rolling Stones come on right after him. What difference does it make? I said, my real heart's in R&B. And then I said, I represented the Tavareses, and I said, I've worked Rick James. I just said, so he says, in the days of cassettes, throws his cassette, and it's a Friday. And he goes, when you go home, play this over the weekend. When you come in Monday, tell me what you're going to do with this artist. There was nothing on it. So I go home, and I play it, and it's the first Anita Baker record that George Duke produced.
Yes.
So I go into his office, and he says, well, what are you going to do? Well, first of all, I tossed the cassette back at him the way he tossed it at me. Guy named Greg Peck, and we became really good friends later on. And he looked at me and he said, you just threw that at me. He said, well, you threw it at me. I'm throwing it back. That's all.
Right.
He says, well, what are you going to do, wise guy? And he said, I'm going to put it on the cover of Jet Magazine. And he looked at me and goes, you really do know what you're doing, don't you?
Uh-huh.
I said, yes. And sure enough, I put it on the cover of Jet Magazine, and I liked working all those acts. I don't see race. I just, Jersey City instilled that in me. You know, we're all in it together. And when I found out how they treat this kind of doo-wop thing and not getting credit, where you sell out the Meadowlands and you only get 50% of the house.
Right.
I thought, you know what, Kenny Vance, how many people did he bring in? 12?
Right.
You know, come on. You know, no indifference to Kenny.
No,
but, you know, so I said to Anthony, I said, look, and he would tell me, he said, George, I hate doing these shows. He said, because I don't get to do my whole show. I don't get to really perform.
Right.
And so I said, then why do you do them? He said, because I make money. We do 15 to 20 shows a year. I said, yeah, but if you hate them, why are you doing something that you hate? So he said, what are you leading up to? I said, why don't you announce you're not going to do them anymore? And he goes, do you realize what you're asking me to do? How much a financial hit I'll take? I said, yeah, I do. I fully understand what I'm asking you to do. So I said, but, you know, you if we do this right, you're going to start making $20,000 to $25,000 a show and doing the same show, but at least you're going to be doing the 90-minute show that you like to do and not just 30 minutes that you hate.
Right. Well, my fantasy is, you know, Bobby Weinstein lives in Boca. You know, we'll get him to come over. We'll give, you know, we'll get, you know, all the usual.
He just wrote a song for Anthony because Anthony's working on a new record.
Yeah, I talk to him all the time.
He was really happy. You know,
yeah.
He's,
Cool.
Because they always had that great chemistry. And but, you know, it's funny how, you know, sometimes we think you got to take chances. And when like I said, Anthony and I have become really good friends. And there's times that, you know, they want him to do something. I go, Anthony, do you really want to do this? And he goes, no. Then why are you even considering it?
Right.
He said, well, I want to do it for the guys. Mm-hmm. I said, well, you stop worrying about the guys. You've been worrying about and taking care of them for over 50 years. Don't you think it's about time you should be taking care of Jerome Anthony Gourdin?
Yeah, but you know, and then again, you got to scratch your head and say, who are the guys?
You know, right. Yeah, there's because, only one. Yeah, Ernest. Exactly.
You know,
left.
I mean, you know, yeah. I don't know what Robert is. I don't know what any of them are doing right now. You know, I see where I talk to Robert on Facebook every once in a while. I guess he's working with.
Well, sold out the Cannery Saturday night.
Okay, cool.
You know, in Vegas, and you know, it was standing. I think there was like two seats open, but a lot of that's because Anthony's written this book.
Yeah.
He's got a higher profile than he's ever had before.
Right.
People have listened to him and do an interview, and whatever they thought he was, they realize this guy's not only a street intellect, but he's like a historian. I mean, he's got opinions on everything, and he's known, like, as you know, he's known everybody. He's like, you know, I kid him one day. I said, Anthony, you ever see that Woody Allen film, Zelig?
Right.
I said, where he's in every famous event that's happened in given period. I said, that's you, Anthony. How many people hung out and shot guns with Elvis Presley at 3 a.m. in the morning in the desert? How many people had Sammy Davis Jr. cook for them ribs and necks? And I said, you performed at Liza Minnelli's wedding. Think about everything that you've done.
No, you're right. Well, you know, and the other thing about that is, you know, you could put Anthony up on stage or put him in a nice lounge chair with a microphone in front of him, and he could do just talk for 90 minutes and not even sing a song.
Well, that's another thing we started. I got Anthony doing this one-man show.
Right.
And he shows slides. He talks about Moms Mabley.
Right.
He talks about Godfrey Cambridge. Because these were all his running buddies. All those people, all those Vegas era.
Right.
And then he tells the story of how Sinatra got him out of his contract with Morris Levy.
Well.
You know, great stuff. And he said, like, but he's so humble, and it took me years to get some of these stories out of him. Like, one day he goes, you know, I had the same manager as Bob Marley. I said, how did that happen? He said, well, he lived in Jamaica. And he said, and I was in the studio. You know, he said, I was in the Island studio, and he was that, you know, that song he did, the I said, No Woman, No Cry?
Right.
Yeah. I was there when he recorded that. And I go, don't you think that was important to tell me at any given time?
Wow.
And he goes, is it important? Yes, Anthony, it is important. And the first time we met, Mike, he came in to do the Songwriters Hall of Fame. They were inducted, Teddy Randazzo and Bobby Weinstein.
Wow.
And so we're at a table, and we're with Henry Juskowitz, we're with Nile Rodgers, and Jackson Brown, who I knew from Elektra, comes up, and he's like, Jackson's like marble mouth talking to Anthony.
Yeah.
He goes, like, you're my idol, man. I can't believe that I'm like in the same room with you. And Anthony goes, I can't believe I'm in the same room with you. He said, you're Jackson Brown. He goes, yeah, but you're little Anthony. and so then we sit down, and Dolly Parton comes in, and Anthony goes, George, he said, there's Dolly Parton. He goes, yeah, that's Dolly Parton. He said, have you never met her? He goes, oh no, I'd be too intimidated.
Wow.
So I said, come on. He said, and Anthony looks at me and he says, you're just going to get me up from this table, walk me over, and you're going to introduce me to Dolly Parton, aren't you? I said, that's exactly what I'm going to do. He said, do you know her? I said, no. What's that got to do with it?
Right.
So I should walk him over, and she goes, little Anthony, I love you.
Right,
and
sure.
She hugs him, and Mike, his mouth turned to marble, too. Like, he couldn't even talk. It's so great. I love you, Dolly.
Wow.
And he still jokes about it to this day.
That's funny.
That's one of the things I love. He just did a benefit for a bunch of lawyers. The Virginia Law Group, I believe it's called, their association. They have a charity. It's called Four Kids Helping Homeless.
Okay.
And Anthony told me, he said that there was a kid there. He said, an autistic savant. Said the kid's blind, but he knew every song that I did.
Wow.
He would even do radio. This is WINS, and we've got little Anthony here. And he said, George, you couldn't even be old enough to even know this, but it was the only thing he connected with. And he said, and I realized, they said, maybe I should just, I got to do something. So I went over and I hugged him. And he said, the kid was just, they said, it's the first time that he's communicated with anybody other than rattling off stuff. And, and he said, then I started singing Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop, and this girl who, he said, has some sort of disability, got up and started dancing. And he said, everybody, it was just such a wonderful experience that I realized that I, how I could touch people.
I want to put my vote in for Traveling Stranger.
Ah.
See, because every, that was one of the tunes. There were certain tunes that separated the men from the boys as far as a cappella group standing on the corner. If you could do Traveling Stranger, see, whoa, 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 I'm, if you could do that, then you were a group. You know what I'm saying? And that was on the short list of tunes like to really be recognized.
But I'll tell you, it was an interesting experience. Like, you know, this guy's flying in. I've never met him. And all of a sudden, I'm introducing him to Dolly Parton. But that's the kind of career life thing that Anthony and I have had. And we've had a lot of fun with stuff like that because I realized that he has no ego whatsoever. And then I said, you know, Anthony, you got to realize you're little Anthony. You're not just anybody. You're rock celebrity. And he said, everywhere he goes, since he's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I'll tell you, that was even great because he got inducted with Metallica and Jeff Beck. And, you know, little Anthony shouldn't even really be in the same sentence with those two.
Exactly.
But because of the induction, he is. And he says, everywhere I go, George, still to this day. Now, here it is. He said, you're talking about 6 years later? He said, everywhere I go, bell captains, I'm in an airport. You belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We, you know, we're so happy for you. And he said, it's amazing. And he said, it always makes me feel so good. And he said, I always remember Smokey Robinson when he inducted us. He said, come up here, Anthony, get the award that you long deserve.
As usual, it's been so great speaking to you. And we've talked about things this time around that we have not touched on before in our conversations. And this time, I've recorded a lot of it. And it's a little bit like George Dassinger, This Is Your Life, but it's always great to talk to you, and I learn a lot when I talk to you, and you've rung an awful lot of bells in your eventful career in history, and it's great stuff. You have a good night, and I'll speak to you soon.
Okay, Mike.